And now, the starting lineup for your...
Gangsters, what's up, guys?
Are you a slacker?
MV.
I'm not going to debate you, Jerry.
God bless the internet.
What the hell's going on out here?
Hello and welcome to Flicking and Screaming. I am Jed Sprague here with my co-hosts, Evan Fagundes.
Hey.
And JT Chipman.
What's going on?
And this week we are finally curling our mustaches. We are inspecting our garden with a magnifying glass. And we are talking about the latest adventure of Hercule Poirot, A Haunting in Venice. But before we get into that, gentlemen, where were you the night? How are you guys doing? I'm not going to try to do a Poirot accent.
You really should. I've been like trying to do it throughout the evening, and it just ends up being vaguely Eastern European and probably offensive. So I'm going to try to avoid it for the most part, but I'm doing very well. It's finally fall. I'm like, oh, hey, haven't pulled out my sweaters in a while. Nice to see you all again in the back of the closet. And that's making me really happy. So I'm doing really good. Evan, what's new with you?
Not a ton. I'm just happy to be here talking about a movie that was out in theaters that all three of us got to see on the big screen. I've been looking forward to this one. So not a ton new. The only regrets that I have, and I hope we get a little snippet from Jed here, is that this last weekend I did miss the Sprague family festivities for Isla's first birthday. And so I'm almost equally as excited to hear about that as I am to talk about this movie with you guys. Jed?
You know, I'm doing well. First birthday for little Isla was, I would say, a resounding success. Poor thing did get a little bit gun-shy when people were singing her happy birthday, broke down into tears. But I almost feel like that's a rite of passage, you know? My older daughter, Charlie, she maybe was a little too into it her first birthday. Some suspect personality traits shining through. Maybe likes the spotlight just a little too much. Isla was like reassuredly cautious when everyone was singing her happy birthday. But she had a great time.
It's good to have that balance in the household, one of each.
Yeah, which is funny because I'm pretty sure Isla's the comedian at this point. It's which is hilarious. But yeah, it was good. You know, parents had a little. All the parents had a little too much wine. We had a lot of kids running around. It was delightful. Painting pumpkins. Still working through all of the alcohol I bought at Costco.
There you go.
Shout out to my pink solo cup that I'm repping on the pod.
Not
tonight.
Only that, but a double pink solo cup. That's a double cup right there.
You got to insulate. You got to insulate.
That's wild that Charlie and Isla didn't finish that off for you, though.
No, wild. I know. Charlie being the party animal that she is. But what I'm really happy about is I made my return to theaters as well this weekend to see A Haunting in Venice, which I can tell you was definitely not the thing like slated as my number one have to see this movie at the beginning of the year after the kind of, I think, head assery that was Death on the Nile. But I'm just going to come out and say it. I think the third adventure of Hercule Poirot was probably the best of the three Brana outings. What did you guys think of this movie?
You're goddamn right. It's the best of the three. I was so happy to get to see this movie. And I was very happy walking out of the theater, too. So I know we did a Death on the Nile episode, and I think we touched on murder a little bit there. And those movies just, especially Death on the Nile, was just memed to death. Not only because of the different castings of folks such as Armie Hammer and Russell Brand and Gal Gadot, but the line readings, the CGI. That movie was a punchline before it was a film, right? And this movie was treated with respect. I think there's an alternative like past where Branagh sinks into making fun of everything, where Branagh and the studio see the reaction Death on the Nile, and they're like, okay, we need to just get stupid with the third one. We need to sink into kind of mocking this genre, more ridiculous, ham-fisted line readings, more outlandish actor choices. And they did swerve into a more specific genre, but I think they did it with a lot of like taste in a weird way, and they like still wanted to put like an excellent product out there. Not to sound all like marketing manager over here, we need an excellent product for Q3 numbers, but I think that they still tried to do something with excellence, and I think they completely achieved it.
Yeah, I do think there's some questionable casting decisions here, though. But we can get into that. Evan, would love to hear your thoughts.
You know, it's so funny. There's only three of these. I hadn't even really considered how I would rank the three of them. I will say Death on the Nile, the opening 20 minutes with the mustache origin story into that intense dance sequence. Like, I don't know if any of the other two have reached that high for me. Like, I was absolutely floating out of the first 25 minutes of Death on the Nile.
The dancing is absolutely wild. You're 100%
wild. And like, I really did like the opening sequence. Like, to me, it was the perfect mixture of that kind of like self-referential camp and somewhat telling a real story and like humanizing this guy at the same time. I thought it was like a very interesting thing. It seemed like kind of the part of the movie that Branagh, because he's telling like this character who he obviously loves story, you know, his background in a way, it seemed like he really took care. The rest of Death on the Nile gets a little bit shaky when they get out on the water. So I'd consider it probably pretty close with this one. As far as filmmaking goes, I'd probably go with this one just because of all of the crazy camera angles and fish eyes and lenses that they were using. Like, that stuff I really did. That was probably my favorite part of this movie was tracking all that stuff.
Yeah, you know, I agree. I thought it was also Branagh's like best performance as Poro for me. I liked the supporting cast around this one the best, save for one, and we'll get to that. But I think the thing that I really loved about this movie is it's genuine. It felt like it's genuine interest in being a horror movie at times. Like, I don't know about you guys. This movie fucking scared me. Like, I was peeking over. I was in the theater. I'm going to put him on blast. But I was in this theater with this, like, ancient-looking man. Just, like, white hair. And it's just me and him. And every time, like, something cracked, I'm, like freaking over my shoulder. And I swear he's just kept getting one seat closer every time there was, you know, like, a window broke or something. It was like, it just had me on the edge of my seat. It had me uncomfortable. And I think like a lot of that has to do with the filmmaking choices, which again, Evan, I agree with you. I think that is the thing that I've taken away from this is like, let's do more cool shit with the camera, guys. It fucking works. I thought this movie looked really good. Even from the outset, it was looking like dreary, but not in that like gray cast, you know, Half-Blood Prince kind of weird way. Or not in like the, you know, Captain America Winter Soldier shit way. It felt like it was like still colored and treated with care. And coming off back of how bad I felt like Death on the Nile looked. And I have not revisited that movie. So I can't, you know, go back and say like directly comparing. But it felt like I was like, all right, hell yeah, Branagh. Evan, was it you that said this the other day? And I think this is just a point we need to like land on and talk about is that it's hilarious that his, you know, his autobiographical, like straight up autobiographical movie was The One for Them. So The One for Him could be more detective movies. Like, that's fucking hysterical. We must cherish this man.
Seen that around Twitter, but it is pretty funny that it does seem to be the case, like where he's just can't wait to get back in the mustache. You know, he's just like Batman looking at his suit in the closet while he's making his like, you know, homespun, you know, childhood story in Belfast and winning an Oscar. Yes. He's like, I got to cut my speech short. I'm going back to have a meeting with Tina Fey.
Kenneth Branagh is so obsessed with himself, but not him. He's obsessed with what he can do. He's a person who like really believes in his abilities to become that other person, whether it's Shakespeare, whether it's Hamlet. Like, he believes in these grand characters that others have invented and that he can adapt. Like, he is the only one who can play Hercule Poirot. He's the only one who can play Henry V or whatever. And I can't help but love that chutzpah, right? Like, I'm just so pro Branagh. I can't even like imagine ever being anti Branagh at any point, or like on the fence about Branagh. I don't want to be Branagh agnostic anymore.
No. I love him so much. The fact that this is what he was doing, just like clearly having so much fun. Like, I thought about it too. There's a shot. I mean, there's a lot of shots that are like, you know, from interesting angles, like, you know, on his a lot of very interesting close-ups. But there's one where he's wearing like he's doing one of those like wearable cameras where it's like pointing like down from his forehead and he's walking around. The camera's like shaking. And it's just I imagine him strapping that on himself and just being like, all right, so here's the play here. And then just like, no, we're going to run another take. Like, again, as he's like watching a daily, you know, he's like watching a take with the thing on his head. And I just like, I kind of am obsessed with the idea of this man. It just, he just feels like what, frankly, like what I would do if I had the skills that he had as like an actor and director. It's like, I'm just going to like, he's basically playing dress up and putting camera on it and getting paid to do it. And he's like, I'm really interested in like essentially hosting murder mystery parties for actors that I see that I like. And, you know, like we're going to populate this with people. Like, it's comical when you look at these films, the actors and actresses that he's populating these movies with are just people from like popular TV shows and movies from the last like 5 years before he filmed it. Like, we literally have Beth from Yellowstone as one of the main characters in this. That is a fucking hysterical choice by our man. You just have to respect it.
Yeah, I just love the idea of him walking out of like a showing of 50 Shades Darker, like, get me Jamie Dornan on the phone right now for my autobiographical film.
Yes, exactly. He, well, he's such like an actor's director too, because he's a stage man, right? Like, he loves Shakespeare. I think his huge draw to these movies is that they're very performance based. They're like stage productions, and he loves getting a ton of characters in the frame at the same time, right? Like, even when the camera's moving around the room, ultimately he's always got to have the wide shot with eight people kind of placed around the room, and it's always like a little bit awkward, but I think it's kind of purposeful. It's like, you know, the way that you would see actors on a stage if you're sitting to the left side of the stage or something like that. I don't know exactly how his mind operates, but I can see what draws him to these, and that's why I think this might have been maybe the best setup for one of these movies, because ultimately, if you're going to create a stage play, the way to make it interesting is by changing lenses, changing camera angles, kind of always keeping you on your toes visually, because the blocking and stuff is there's not like much physical action, I guess, happening on the screen.
Yeah, it weirdly, I feel like this is going to sound fucking insane, and you guys are going to like laugh at me. But I feel like he watched The Lighthouse in between Death on the Nile and this. Like, there's a lot where I'm just like, yeah, like that's kind of like you watch The Lighthouse and like just being like, let's do weird stuff with the camera while people talk in rooms. And like, let's put them in interesting and like uncomfortable angles to create tension and drama like a stage play. But understanding that this is a different medium, I think it just does that so much better than what felt like we're just so much more like straight ahead. And I think what delights me so much about this movie is that it was such a surprise. I mean, we heard rumblings, we heard whisperings, you know, like Twitter was all ablaze when this movie came out. And so like, I had plenty of time to be like, oh my gosh, I'm hearing it's actually good. I'm going to go in with, you know, high expectations, but I cannot imagine like sitting down at a film, like being a critic sitting down at a film festival and being like, oh God, I can't believe we're making a third one of these things after like those first two. And then being like, Oh my God. Okay, that's different. Well, that's different too. And just the whole movie being what feels like in the hands of a different filmmaker. It really what it feels like is like a franchise that they handed the reins to a new director in the third thing, but it's just still him, which is amazing. It's so cool. I love when people can reinvent themselves like that.
It's really, it doesn't feel like it's made by the same person. Like, other than the way it's, I think there's some similarities with dialogue and screenplay, but just in terms of filming style, you would imagine that there's a different, completely different team behind it. And it's not, it's still Branagh. And I, you know, maybe he had to eat a little bit of humble pie after Death on the Nile. Maybe this was his way of saying, hey, hand up, I phoned that one in. Let me show y'all a little something. Here goes something different for y'all, kind of thing is what he was doing. And I was just so happy walking out of it. I don't know. I know, Jed, you found it a little scary. I think that it didn't completely scare me, but I enjoyed that there was genuine spook to it. There was some genuine moments. Like, there were a couple of really good jump scares. There was some good tense music, and the characters were just so unnerved the entire time, you know? And I think I really believed that sense of everyone being on edge, and it helps when the screenplay, maybe the screenplay feels a little stilted at times. Maybe sometimes the dialogue feels a little bit odd, but when these characters are in a haunted house on Halloween with all this crazy stuff happening around them, I buy that setting a little bit more for this type of screenplay that he wants to write.
I also will say, like, creepy girls are like creepy small female children is like number one on my scare list. You know, it's like that is the creepiest thing. Like singing, especially you add that to it. Like I even get a little spooked at like the beginning of Pirates of the Caribbean at World's End. You know, I'm just like when the yo ho yo, I'm like just dude, crawling in my skin. It's just not,
love that. I will watch it on YouTube any day. Love yeah. Me too.
But that's why I think I was like predisposed to be a little scared. So we kind of teased a little bit that these movies, right, are Brenna and, you know, bringing some actors and actresses that he finds interesting into the fold. Let's talk about some of our favorite performances. But before we get to that, I did tease out a questionable casting decision. What the fuck is Tina Fey doing in this movie? Like it literally looks like she's doing an SNL version of like a 1950s, you know, strong woman. You know, I'm a little sassy. And it's like I just, that's my like beef with Brenna is like, he just let her do it. He's like, she's making a choice and I support choices. Like, just have her talk normal. She already feels like she doesn't belong. The way she reacts to everything else, she feels firmly in like a satire and everybody else feels like they're actually in the movie. It's just, I couldn't get there with her. It actively took me out of the movie basically every time she was on screen, and that was tough, especially she has some like really key moments to deliver. What do you guys think of Tina Fey?
Yeah, it's almost a reverse from something Evan was talking about, where the mustache and the dancing at the beginning of Death on the Nile really drew him in. Tina Fey being heavy at the beginning of the film threw up some red flags for me at first, and I was like, oh shit, is this the tone? And it wasn't the tone, fortunately, but I mean, she was,
would have fit right in with Death on the Nile.
Oh, for sure.
Her and Gal Gadot would have had an amazing conversation.
Maybe would have made the movie better. I don't. You can't save that movie. Yeah. I mean, you say SNL performance because that's what she's done for a long time, and it's like, you pull up the same trick after a while. And I know who you are. I see you, Tina Fey, doing this, and I'm not. I just didn't really laugh that much anymore. It's tough. It's like, I don't want to call Tina Fey washed. I don't want to be like, hey, you know, you're like, I don't know, you're like Dwight Howard in 2019, but it's like, I don't know if you've got the same, you don't got the hops anymore.
Yeah, this just might not be the movie for her, and I don't think she's the only one, actually, that I had a bit of an issue with. We'll kind of keep going through, but I think that's what makes the first 20 minutes of our conversation pretty funny, is because we're ascribing a lot to Kenneth Branagh's like decision-making, right? Because he is somebody who's very fun to think about, because, you know, the last time that we talked about him was as a very exciting side character in Oppenheimer, in which he's great. And they even do like a superhero reveal at one point where a character steps out of the way and everyone in the room is like, oh, Kenneth Branagh, you know, it like it's and then for him to do this stuff. It's hard for me to figure out what he's going for in these movies because of the acting. And Jed, you might have absolutely tapped into something where he's such an actor's director that he's just like, here's your part. Take 3 months. You come back with ideas, and whatever ideas you've settled on, let's run with it. And everyone is reading the script on their own and then coming back and is like, this is the tone I have. This is what who my character is. And then he's just like, great. We're all shooting on different days, you know, and
it feels like acting. It feels a little like acting class, like the most supportive. And he's like, I'm bringing everyone together. And he, you know, Tina Fey is just like bombing on set. And he's like, you know what? I'm so proud of her for making choices. Like, we're going to support actors that make choices in these, you know, and it's just
it's very interesting. Like, I really, really thought she was miscast. And I think there is a place for a Tina Fey in this type of movie. Like, there are people coming in and out that I think she, you know, could be in. I'd be happy to see something that Tina Fey is part of writing and stuff. Like, I love the way that she writes. And I think she writes good characters for herself. But I definitely struggled with her in this movie. It threw the tone of the movie so much. And like her and Branagh sharing the screen was very, very hard for me because of how much he's doing in Poirot.
Especially when it's her, Branagh, and then Ricardo Scamario, who plays the cop. Yes, Scamario, who plays the point guard cop. Him and Poirot, when they were together, I thought were kind of like pitch perfect on like the same note. And so she's just stuck out even more like a sore thumb when the camera's just flashing back and forth. And it looks like she's almost like trying to hold back a smile. It's like it was so strange. I didn't get it.
And you, Evan, you said a character like this can go in and out. If she would have gone out and like dropped Poirot off at the house and just been out of the movie and like maybe came back at the end to like pick him up. Totally different. But the fact that she is present and very active and becomes very central to the plot the farther on the movie goes, it just gets old. It becomes less of a cameo. If it was like a cameo, you could almost forgive it and be like, sure, let Tina Fey cook for 5 minutes. Well, she kind of cooks for like 65 minutes.
She's crucial to the plot, right? Like she's like the plot driver in this movie.
In a lot of ways, yeah.
It was kind of like Matt Damon cameo energy, but for like a whole movie, you know, like it's like
Scotty, what if we made the whole movie of Matt Damon cameos?
No, that's what Death on the Nile. It's like when he pops up in Eurotrip singing Scotty Doesn't Know, and then they're just like, what if the character is just like with them the whole time, you know? And then you're just like faced with the reality of like, oh, there's like a shaved head Matt Damon just like in this movie.
It's just like Interstellar 2, the story of man, and it's just him asleep in the pod for like 2.5 hours.
Yeah, no, it was
just driving the whole thing.
It is, I don't know. Evan, you teased out that there were some other performances that you didn't quite love, and I would really be interested to know. I hope you're not coming after who I think you're coming after.
Okay. Well, I did want to. It's funny. We opened with like who did we like, and now we're just gonna be shitting on people. But
no, we didn't open with who do we like. I want to talk about who we didn't like before.
Again. It's a tone thing for me. I don't even think individual people are giving bad performances for what they're doing, but it just doesn't fit. Like Jamie Dornan to me is putting so much mustard on the hot dog. I'm just like, what movie are you in, sir? Like, I'm not sure if it's the movie that this is, but I think it's part of what gets me a little bit with the storytelling in these movies, which is that it's very hard for me to tell whose story we're supposed to take seriously and whose we're not. Because he is doing like full, like, you know, post Dunkirk performance, and this movie just didn't feel like it was that. So I was just really kind of thrown off tonally every time he was on the screen. And it just felt so much like person in acting school playing PTSD to me, I will say.
That's fair.
The thing is who you take seriously. Poirot tells you who you should take seriously. I think that's the point, is that in the same way that the director knows which actor belongs, Poirot, as the master of the setting, is the one who's going to tell you, hey, we can ignore this person or they're actually going to matter. He won't tell you until the very end. He's going to take everyone at face value up until then. And you have to try to read between the lines a little bit. So I kind of like being taken for that ride.
That's fair.
I was, anybody else that you thought was kind of a miss before we talk about? Because I actually think there was like a couple performances that I thought were like killer.
Yeah, I don't know. Now I kind of feel bad. I mean, I don't think Dornan was far. I don't know. We'll talk about it a little bit more. The opening to this podcast was very glowing, which I'm very happy. And I want to hear lots of great takes about this movie. I don't know. I think we can talk about performances that we liked. There was definitely,
I thought Michelle Yeoh was fucking spectacular.
Yeah,
in her 20, like out of control. Like if Tina Fey took me out of the movie, Michelle Yeoh's performance brought me into the movie.
100%.
Like, it was the moment where I was like, holy shit. Like, hell yeah. I thought she was spectacular. And when her character shows up, that's when the movie gets real. That's when things like start to, and I was really sad that she ended up getting murdered.
I missed her.
Like, I really thought
she brought an energy that I think these movies could do with a little bit more. It's funny because it's a murder mystery and there's like a surprise every 20 minutes, but I feel like I could use a little bit more juice.
Yeah.
And she was the juice for sure.
Definitely. Anybody
That's
else?
A good one.
Shout out guys. Jude Hill. Shout out. When there's a good performance,
feel like you're,
I
totally you agree. I agree with you, but I feel like you're in total like retcon mode with your I hate child
about?
Actors takes. Like you're completely walking this back.
You I've been them. So you consistent. No. It's implied that every other child actor is bad. So when I'm talking about a good child actor performance, it's like this is the exception that proves the rule.
Okay.
He was good. He was like
very good.
He's
very
got
good.
His little cute glasses on, and it's fun when a child talks like an adult to an adult who's talking like a child, like him to Jamie Dornan, that little relationship, very, very believable. It's like, oh, this kid has had to become the parent because his dad has been completely broken by the war. Dug that dynamic, dug his little like send off at the end from Poirot, where it's like, this is like a Batman Robin situation almost, where Poirot sees a lot of himself in the little kid, but also he sees that the kid can do things that he can't do. Like Jude Hill's character, his ability to kind of see beyond the physical world, to dig into the metaphysical, to deal with the ghost and the spiritual, that he's not afraid of it, that he views it as, I don't know, a regular and natural thing that we should all become accustomed to. Poirot can't do that. And I think he recognizes that at the end of the movie, I think he recognizes that shortcoming within himself. And he knows that Jude Hill doesn't have that shortcoming. So he wants him, you know, he sends him off literally to see like in the canals of Venice on that boat. And he's like, that kid's going to be better than me one day. And I thought that was cool.
I agree. I thought he was very good.
Great stuff out of him.
Which is also great because he plays the young Brana character in Belfast. So it's also like Brana saying, this kid is going to be as good as me or better one day, which is
I like that take.
And the
a lot.
Best part of, I love the idea too of like, you know, Scorsese as De Niro, like all these pairings, and then it's like Brana has Jude Hill. He has like a 9-year-old that he's just like, this is my muse.
Picked him up.
Can I throw out Kelly Riley?
Yeah, please.
I think she's incredible
waiting.
In everything. See, like, she has the exact type of unpredictable energy that I latch onto in movies like this, and she's so good at doing the like breathy, freaked out. I really enjoyed her performance.
She is so chaotic, like her natural state, just chaos. I love watching her, and like I know her, like her character in Yellowstone is like meme to death because it is like chaotic to, you know, the nth degree, and I think it's gotten more chaotic as that show's, you know, seemingly run out of ideas. But like, let's not forget, like that her performance in that show, like in the first two seasons especially, is like fucking really good, and I think she's been good in everything I've seen her in since. Like, I don't understand how she's not
great in Flight. She is so good in Flight,
dude. She's awesome, and I just love, like, feels like she's used really well, consistently used really well. And I would really love to see something. This is like a very specific request. I would love to see her and Anya Taylor-Joy in something together. It just feels like they would be able to cap, like, they're kind of like same but different for me, where I feel like every time I watch Anya Taylor-Joy in something, it's like this collected chaos, and then Kelly Riley's like chaos on the surface, if that makes sense. But I just feel like their like energies would like really, I don't know, it would feel like they would match.
I mean, they're both very like old-fashioned looking too, in a way. Like they fit in, Kelly Riley fit in so well into the setting, which is, and I mean, we haven't really talked about it, but like, it makes me want to go back and watch the 40s and 50s horror movies, right? Because that's like totally what this movie is pulling from, the same way like Tim Burton pulls from movies like that all the time, and that type of look, and her whole vibe, I feel like, fits very well into that setting.
Honestly, he should have done this in black and white. I'm going to like that with this movie.
Yeah, release the black and white cut, Brana. You know you wanted to. I wonder if he thought about it. I wonder if he like tried to pitch, because he did it with Belfast.
Yeah.
But he has to make like $150 million at these movies. That's what's so funny about these movies is that they're so expensive.
Yeah.
I think there's something suspicious about that. You want to see the books?
No, now I won't say that I see all the money on screen, because I don't, but I mean, I don't know. Does Tina Fey, is Tina Fey like $8 million? Like, I honestly don't know.
Probably. Like,
Kenneth, you know, his rider, you know, includes like gold bars. I don't know exactly what he's up to, but
the gold, it's the gold bars from Tenet.
Before, hey, before we hop into like Brenna's performance, like as Poirot, because like we talked about, he's often the most confusing part of this because he just like is shifting in and out of parody and like the most serious, but in a way that I kind of find charming. I'd love to know. So we've had like a couple of like kind of weird cat, like who is like, if they're going to do a fourth one, who do you want to see? Like, that's just kind of like an off the wall casting. I think like from a, if I'm thinking comedians, God, I mean, I'd love to see Will Ferrell. I mean, I feel like I feel like Will could actually like pit, like could throw the right, he could throw the right pitch to land one of these movies. I could see that. Oh,
I like that idea. I want to see James Marsden.
Yes,
that is yes.
But that's not, that doesn't feel that like.
You need like one kind of sincere, kind of doe-eyed, like not quite a straight man, but. Someone who can just be like, Poirot, what's going on? I'm just, can you help me figure out where my daughter is? You know, that's what Marsden needs to bring to one of these movies.
I agree. Like, I think that's the type, that's the exact type of energy that I'm thinking of. Like, even like Ferrell, while I'd love to see him in anything, Jed, he feels like Tina Fey to me, where like the whole time he's so in on the joke that it makes the movie a joke a little bit, versus like James Marsden is, you know, can do the comedy, but can, but is a, you know, is a dramatic actor as well.
Yeah, I got you. I just completely misheard Chip saying not a straight man as like, like James Marsden, like not quite straight, not quite a straight man. Like
James Marsden, famously rather gay.
Oh my God, that just killed me. Like I realized immediately like that I misheard it, but I was like,
no, that's totally fair. I don't, has James Marsden ever played a gay character? I don't think he has. Oh. Off the top of my head, but I would love to see that.
That cracked me up.
James Evan, Marsden as Hercule Poirot's partner. How about that?
Mm. Now you're just writing Knives Out Chip, fanfic.
Don't give it away for free.
What about you, Evan?
God, that's a good.
James Marsden's excellent, by the way. Love that pull.
That's a good question. I don't know. Like, I kind of like when people who are very serious actors, like, I think what Michelle Yeoh brought to this movie, and she's definitely overqualified to be in one of these movies, but, like, Marion Cotillard, like, somebody like that for, like, 15 minutes, I think could be really
Olivia effective. Coleman?
Like, it's those people that kind of always keep you off guard. Who did you say, Jen?
Olivia Colman.
I mean, like Olivia Colman could elevate anything.
Yeah,
Olivia,
I mean, Coleman, she elevated The Bear
around
she...
and win an Oscar in the ninth Poirot.
Listen, I just feel like, I think that's like the easiest layup. It's like, would Denzel Washington make this movie better? Yes. Like, you know, would one of the greatest actors of a generation make this better?
You know who I could see being very good is Viola Davis.
Yeah.
In these types of movies. Because she is like, oh, she just has the intensity that I feel like
she would for sure, though. Like, the thing about it is the opportunity was basically this movie to play the Kelly Riley character, because she could have done that like ending like that. She would have to be the villain of like the get found out, like the ending turn shouting at everybody is just, she would kill that. Let's talk about Brenna. Let's talk about the man behind the stash. Are these performances good? Like, are they good acting performances, or is it just like a vehicle for him to have fun? I don't know where I land on it, and I really like want to pick your guys' brains.
I honestly like, I enjoy him in these movies. I really, really love when he does the gags. I actually like less of when he's talking, like him almost drowning while bobbing for apples is one of the funnier things that I've seen in any movie this year at all. And it was, you know, to an extent, a bit harrowing for half a second there. But I love when he's like having to physically do something as Poirot. When he's talking to people, I mean, I think it's what he wants to do. You know, it's funny. I don't, it's okay, I guess. I don't know where to go. It's hard to judge it.
You're wavering. You're like caught in between second and third base right now.
Something like that. I mean, I just, this may sound like pretentious almost or something, but it's like, it's hard for me to even grade on a scale because I can't tell exactly what he's, you know, what he's getting out of it and, or what he wants me as an audience member to get out of it. I'm kind of talking myself in circles here.
Maybe you're saying that it's Brano who's actually caught in between second and third, and he neither needs to commit to a stand up double or actually go all the way and try to slide in for the three bagger.
Maybe. I think these movies could be a little crazier, I will say, and I think he's a little bit of a part of that. But
in crazier, in what way? Like shit, more shit hitting the fan, or do you mean like making more like weird choices?
Yeah, just like,
I think the thing that he likes
about
it,
maybe
the thing
that you like more volatility, even you
the
know,
thing
like
that you clued in on though, which is he likes this. Agatha Christie, we have to get everyone locked in a setting. Like, literally every single movie has him, like, closing doors and being like, no one is leaving this room until the murder is solved. You know, it's just like...
Your Poirot is pretty good, I gotta say.
Yeah, it is.
It's got a little bit more powdered sugar on the beignet, if you wanna, you know, if you're catching my drift. But it's, it's in the ballpark.
You know what I like is when he's going POV with the camera and he's following the like possible little ghost child through
yes,
the castle. Like I wish there was a little
about.
Bit more of that, but what he wants to do is he wants to have Poirot question people about, but not even question them. Just say like, tell me your story. And then they just talk for 12 minutes. And then he goes to the next person. He's like, tell me your, like, he's not even really accusing people very often. I almost wish there was a little bit more like, you did it.
But
and then
that's why he has the sidekick, right? Like, I think that's almost a victim of the material, not like as much of a choice. Because, right, he always has the sidekick that's jumping to the conclusions. And he's like, no, we must stick to the process. It's just so, like, it's just so, I guess, and this is the criticism you could levy at Agatha Christie novels. It is so cut and paste. Right. It is. It's what that the movie. What was it called? With Saoirse Ronan, Sam Rockwell, that came out. That was so, like so actively bad.
See how they run.
See how they run. Which like had potential. That's what they were trying to poke fun at. Right. Is like this idea that,
sure.
Like all the tropes, everything that, and the thing that Brana's doing, obviously, because he's telling those stories, not like a variation on that story is. He's just like, yeah, this is just what they are. And I'm going to buy in to what I think is this beautiful art form. And that's why I almost feel like he can just make a thousand of these, is because I think he just likes being in this world of like, I'm in terror. Like you said, there's just, it's like a built in moment, like moments, right? I'm going to interrogate this person. Somebody else is going, most likely two people are going to die over the course of this movie, right? You know that Michelle Yeoh's character isn't the only one who's going to die. Like there's very clearly always has to be somebody else that gets involved. And you know that the murderer is somebody that you can see. And so it's just this, I think it's just like for him, it's just like, let's find a cool setting to do it. Let's continue to have these conversations. And let's try to like pair myself with other performers that I think can like deliver this and do this well. And I almost think this being as, and I'm going to say it, being as good as it was kind of makes you question the form and like what he's trying to get out of this. But if this was just another straight up mediocre, you'd be like, yeah, he just likes doing these, you know, telling these stories. He wants to do them the same, but him doing this and like showing a lot of love for the horror genre and him making a lot of interesting choices with his camera angles and his lighting and his, and it, frankly, the sound, like there's a lot of interesting sound that happens with the crashing of the waves. Everything moves at like a chaotic, almost not like Oppenheimer, but like in that way, there are moments where it's just like constant cascading and, you know, you don't get a breath, which is very unlike what the first two movies are, where it's all breath and just chat. And he has like small stretches in this movie where it's a bit of a rush. And so this has almost made me question what he thinks he's supposed to be doing with these movies. And that's where I'm like confused, if that makes any sense at all.
I don't know if there's a hard and fast direction that he wants to go. I think that I don't know if he was guided or if he guided himself towards saying, hey, let's put some paprika on this one. Let's add some extra seasoning. Let's mix it up a little bit. That led to choosing this particular one. I'd be curious to know. I mean, obviously, with the different strikes going on, I feel like there hasn't been a lot of press surrounding, but like I want to know, like, why did he pick Haunting of Venice specifically? Why did he go down the road of the gothic horror influences, right? Like, it's obviously a great story. It's so cool. Like, it's a haunted house that's also on the water, you know. It's but just like one of those ideas that's kind of a bong hit idea from Agatha Christie, but also works so well.
But isn't it based on like, not, it's called like Halloween Party.
Right, that's the Agatha Christie. Yeah. It's not called A Haunting in Venice. The novel is not called Haunting in Venice.
Is it set in Venice though?
I have no idea.
I think they changed.
If that was a change that they made to put it in Venice, to put it on the canals, in the water, to add like those logs ramming into it, to make it in a storm.
But regardless
of whether it was a choice on their end or whether it was Agatha Christie putting it in the novel, I think it is such a cool, like, it's a great idea for them to bring to life. And again, I think a perfect way to right the wrongs of the franchise, because like Murder on the Orient Express was like a very inoffensive beginning. I think it didn't really, my problem with Murder on the Orient Express is that I just don't like stories where everyone did it. Like, I need a proper villain. And instead it's like, everyone was in on it from the beginning. And it's like, okay, well, I'm bored. I'm going to leave the theater now. Death on the Nile was pure laughingstock. And this is the one where it all like finally came together. And it makes me really excited for where he's going in the future. I agree that like, I'm not 100% sure if he's got like a super solid direction for the arc of Hercule Poirot. I don't know if he knows exactly where he wants him to end up at the end. I think that he might make these movies until he dies. And I'm like, the man Kenneth Branagh dies. But especially after this movie, I'm totally okay with that. Even if it's like, if he goes the same pattern of one inoffensive, one meme, one good in terms of his Poirot movies, I'm like, all right. It's fine. These movies are like made for adults. Like, I'll take that franchise.
Yeah. So this is the biggest stretch. So this is loosely based on Halloween Party, which is the Agatha Christie story of a 13-year-old girl boasts that she once witnessed a murder. When no one believes her, she storms off home. But within an hour, her body is found drowned in an apple bobbing tub. But that does not take place in Venice, and like none of the other characters. So this is actually like, again, it's adapted screenplay technically. But Michael Green kind of used that, like some of the ideas, and then wrote A Haunting in Venice based on those ideas. So this is technically, funnily enough, this is like an original story, original take on the story.
I think I falsely attributed the screenplay to Branagh earlier. So apologies to Michael Green.
I think he has a credit.
He might have a credit.
Yeah, he has a credit.
Green is kind of the main guy. And Green, interesting. I'm seeing Blade Runner 2049, Logan, Alien Covenant. Quite the run here. There's also
a lot of Branagh. Colette Sarah too. Jungle Cruise.
Wow.
Interesting. Well, interesting.
We need the genre career guys. You know, we need our big genre writers to write genre shit.
I think that the other interesting thing is this the same DP that he's worked with? His name's Harris. Zimbarco.
I was looking. Yes, going back to Shadow Recruit. Well, Sleuth he made with Branagh, but Thor, Shadow Recruit, Cinderella, Artemis Fowl, all three of these Poirot movies he's made. You know, I was looking up the same thing, Jed. I'm very curious about the cinematographer. I didn't really know him. Harris Zimbarlukos. He's a Greek guy. And I was thinking for this movie specifically, I just was thinking a lot about Tim Burton and like, obviously, like I said earlier, it's drawn on lots of the same influences, and just realized that he is shooting Beetlejuice 2. I just saw this online right now.
Oh, cool.
Which is, I mean, obviously, Burton is seeing something similar because he's never shot a Burton movie before. But they obviously have similar sensibilities, and that might be a little bit, you know, I wonder if
he did
having early conversations with Burton possibly could have, you know, contributed to the look and the feel of this movie. You never know, but
this guy's kind of a legend. He did Locke, and then he also did Mamma Mia.
Hell yeah. Yes. What a double feature.
Yeah, those are these are good.
Did he
movies.
Do both Mamma Mias or just the original?
Just the OG.
Just the first.
Even better.
2008. Yeah, that's exactly good. Good call. Interesting. Yeah, he's had a very interesting.
Locke's a great looking movie.
Fantastic. And I think Mamma Mia is a fantastic movie too.
It is. That's true.
All right. Any favorite moments?
Beautiful movie.
Any favorite moments before we wrap and give it a score? We've talked a lot about like camera moments, and I think we talked about like Michelle Yeoh coming on screen and stuff like that. But anything else that you guys really loved?
Okay, so it's not a favorite moment. Can I just really quick give my spiel on my struggles with these movies and with this movie as well. And it kind of comes back to favorite moments, because I actually did. I mean, the Michelle Yeoh scenes were, I thought, excellent, and I was really in. I know these movies have to do the whole point of these movies is to get to the interrogation scenes. Like that's where the meat of these movies are. And to me, that's like some of the best stuff in Knives Out are those early interrogation scenes, because that's how these movies do character building, right? Is like literally the character telling the investigator who they are. Sometimes they're lying, sometimes they're telling the truth. We kind of have to figure that out as we go. So I know it's inherent to the genre. I'm not saying they shouldn't have those in these movies specifically, and I think it has a little bit to do with the writing, but maybe the performance style as well. Guys, I literally don't remember what happens in these movies. Like, I remember who the killer is and stuff at the end of them, but I like legitimately do not remember any dialogue from any of the three of these movies. And The Haunting in Venice I saw maybe 2 weeks ago. I don't know what it is. Like, and maybe that's my fault as a viewer, but I'm able to, you know, without tooting my own horn, follow a lot of movies, you know, decently to an extent and remember what happens in them. And man, these movies really go in one ear, out the other. Like, the stuff that I really remember and love are those little moments between interrogations that are very interesting. Like when they discover Jamie Dornan's body, for example. That's the type of exciting stuff that I get, you know, juice for. But that's my hold up with these.
Yeah, I would say the difference, and I think you make a great point there, and I think part of this is just like the character of Poirot being this like all-knowing, omnipotent, invincible detective, versus if we want to put Detective Foghorn Leghorn up against him from Knives Out, right? Like, he doesn't quite seem as invincible. He's much more like, you watch him kind of grappling with the mystery. Poirot is so, everything is so shielded from us that you almost turn your brain off and you're like, he's gonna tell me how it all got figured out. I don't need to work on it with him. Like, there's an element to that where you are almost the sidekick detective that all of these movies have, right? There's the main detective and then there is the helper. The helper is often the most avatar for the audience, like within the film, right? And if you watch Knives Out, what's so great about it is his sidekick is always, they are always having conversations where things are in doubt, right? Like, he's making assumptions and then being, no, that wouldn't make any sense. You know, they're throwing out things, they're having conversations where the entire time in all three of these Hercule Poirot movies, it is the sidekick jumping to rash conclusions and Poirot telling them why they're wrong and telling them why, like, they shouldn't be jumping to that, but never himself actually grappling with the mystery. It seems as though he always knows what's happening. And so as an audience member, you trust in him. And so you turn off your brain to like having to unravel the mystery yourself. That's my theory.
I like when Poirot is just like, I know everything. I just need to go find out one more thing to figure out what the full mystery is. And it's like, I know nothing, man. And the side detective also says that they know nothing. But I love it. Again, I think I said earlier, I'm along for the ride in these movies. I'm okay with not every single line of dialogue grabbing me. If, in fact, I am lost in a whole line of dialogues, that's okay. Because I buy the ticket for the 7 minutes where Poirot clears out.
Yeah, it's like my, it's the, it's essentially like the line from Barbie, you know, when they come back and the patriarchy's established and they're talking to Emma Mackey, Emma Mackey's Barbie, and she's like supposed to be a physicist. And she's like, I love the patriarchy. I don't have to think anymore. It's like a spa day for my brain every day. You know, like that's how I feel when I'm watching a Hercule Poirot movie. My brain's on vacation. Like, I know that he's going to tell me what happens at the end of this.
But I also don't feel talked down to at the same time. I don't feel like the movie's making me out to be an idiot in any way. Because there are certain things that you can still try to follow and pick out, like with the honey and with the flowers and everything. We barely talked about the plot of this movie, like, at all. Because it's kind of not really the point and not what we want to talk about when we talk about these kind
of things. And he does, like, I feel like in this one he throws more, like, red herring symbolism, right? Like, all the apples and then her, like, the, you know, Tina Fey's character's thing being that she eats apples every day until the afternoon. Like, that's on their first meeting that gets mentioned, and the apple kicks everything off. And then they're like, you know, it's like he's like hallucinating and reading the card, the invitation card, and it shows apple on it. And you're like, oh, Tina Fey's character is the one that did it, you know. But at the end, you're just like, have a brewski beer, my big smart detective man. Like, that's, you know, that's how I feel about these movies. And that's why, like, I personally prefer movies where, like, I have to do, like, where the detective is clearly a little bit unsure and you're kind of, like, wavering with them. And so you're more incentivized to do a little bit of the work yourself. I don't know. I like that. Mm-hmm. Sometimes too much trust is a good thing, or is a bad thing. Apologies.
Apologies. I don't think... it might be proving Evan's point that I don't have, like, one particular moment that I would love to talk about for the movie. But I will say, when they go downstairs, when Rana finds the door. Yeah. Ooh, Jed, I know that probably got you.
Yeah, dude, when they... when he, like, hallucinates and all the bees, like, fly out of that dead... the skeleton.
Yeah.
Oof, yeah. Gnarly. Just that...
It's
the gravity of the, like, wow, they really did lock those children down here was fucking gnarly.
Yes. I'm sure that stop motion, like, video that they play the kids. That was a spooky intro.
That was, man. That was one of the scariest, like, that whole, like, beginning to the orphan party. I'm like, are all these orphans going to die in front of Hercule Poirot? Like, is that the mystery?
That would be wild. I was like, and I was then like, it's just Tina Fey, like, whoa.
Wow, we really got ourselves in a pickle here, huh, Poirot?
There's just like 50 dead children. She's just like, oh boy.
Well, I'm definitely going to base my next book on this one. and that's the show. My accent work is something today.
Tina Fey, but you know, it is.
Let's give this grade and let's get out of here.
B+. Best of the series by far. Reinvigorated my love for the series. Stance on Brana confirmed.
Was it confirmed? I don't remember you being like. I remember us inching closer to being pro Brana. Like,
yeah, no, there's no going back for me at this point. The next mediocre one, I will stand on that island alone while Film Twitter hops off the bandwagon again. Film Twitter was like, this movie looks like Orson Welles. And then the next one's going to come along and it's going to be a piece of shit. And I'm going to be like, I don't care. I still like it. And everybody else is going to be.
By the way, every time Film Twitter does that, it's like, I know exactly what they're talking about. It's because he did the above, like, the forehead angle close-up shot, and it's like the meme. It's like guy who's only seen Boss Baby and then watches, you know, and then watches a second movie. I'm getting a lot of Boss Baby vibes from this movie. Like, that's as much Orson Welles.
It's like
as
one fucking shadow in the movie. They're like, it's holy so shit, true. He made a real one.
It's so true, but at the same time, it is like, it's so wild to have a genre movie like this have a distinct visual language. It's cool.
Chip, that doesn't make it Orson Welles. Like, everyone needs to fucking calm down. Like, and I know I'm the king of, like, stretch, you know, analogies.
We're starved for good movies and good films.
Evan, did you ask me a question?
Yeah, did you like Belfast? I'm just curious. Because I'm also staunchly pro Brana.
Mm-hmm.
Did not like Belfast.
I think I was charmed by it, but then I forgot about it, so.
Yeah. And I haven't even, just, the more I look at his filmography, the more I'm like, holy shit, I haven't seen like so many of these.
He's made so many movies, dude.
Like, did you see Artemis Fowl? That came out like 2.5 years ago.
No, and I'm not, I don't have a, I'm not going to see Artemis Fowl either. Like, I, my pro Brana stance has limits.
But like his most recent output is like,
I don't honestly, I have no recollection.
Artemis Fowl, Cinderella.
He makes, honestly, Brana makes a bunch of movies that you can just forget, and then he makes some good ones too. He's just a fucking, he's like weirdly a journeyman, but also like runs Hollywood. I don't know. I don't get it.
He's so weird. It is wild that he made Cinderella. That movie made so much money, and I haven't seen it.
Actually, probably the first of the live action Disneys and the best of the live action Disneys, I would say.
You know what? I'm not making a meme. Like, I 100% believe you that that would be the best.
It's either that one or Jungle Book. Directed by, I think Jungle Book was directed by Favreau.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
I think. I like Jungle Book. Like Cinderella, probably, what, it made like $1.2 billion or something. And like there is a like a 12% chance that it doesn't exist. That it's not real and just on his Wikipedia page.
Seen it. I've seen it though. I've seen it with my own two eyes. Evan, I need a grade out of you. I got a B plus.
C plus.
Okay. Tina Fey took you out of it that much?
I think just the whole thing. I just, it's so in one ear, out the other. I really liked the way this movie looked at times, but yeah.
I think.
Do you believe in ghosts?
On the record, do you believe in ghosts?
I can't say that I do. And of course, now I'm setting myself up, but I can't really say that.
This will be the last podcast that we hear from Evan Fagundes, unfortunately.
You're not a doctor or a nurse, are you, Evan?
We podcasted from the other side.
Evan's joining us. And is this Clint Eastwood top 5 podcast in the room with us right now?
No. Oh no. Oh,
you guys are going to like a, you know, one of the, like a seance, and the lady's like, he's talking about a director with lots of hits, but many misses. Like, still trying to talk chronic.
Ask him what he thought about Goodfellas. That'll get him. I thought it was a solid B for me. I was pleasantly surprised at how much better it was than, I think it's miles, leagues above the previous two in this franchise. And, you know, I won't be mad if he makes a fourth, if he decides to do something distinct with it. But yeah, that's all I got. I think positive from us, not this movie is Orson Welles, and this is one of the finest meditations on death and grief and loss of our generation that I was seeing in the early weeks of Twitter. But I enjoyed this movie and happy we got to talk about it tonight, and happy I got to see it in a theater. I will never take that for granted, which that always bumps up like half a letter grade. You know, it takes from like a B minus to a B for me. Thank you so much for listening, as always. If you haven't already, follow us on Twitter at Flick and Scream, on Instagram at Flicking and Screaming. We made a reel over there, guys. Things are getting real. We made a
really
reel.
Good reel.
If you haven't already, join us on flickingandscreaming.com for some wonderful blogs and blog posts. Evan has a recent one that is some of the best moments from Oppenheimer that is well worth your read if you enjoyed that movie.
And Evan made the reel as well. I want to give credit. Evan did create the fantastic Christopher Nolan ranking reel. So
he did.
Really carrying more weight than he should. I respect it.
Thank you. He is on it. Until next time, I'm Jed Sprague, Evan Fagundes, JT Chipman. Hey, everybody.
See ya.
Good night, everybody.
And now, the starting lineup for your
Gangsters. What's up, guys?
Are you a slacker?
MV.
I'm not going to debate you, Jerry.
God bless the internet.